This is Dr. Rebecca Daniel Burke, your host for the American Counseling Association's 2014 podcast series. Today we are speaking with Dr. Stephanie F. Daly about her book, DSM-5, Learning Companion for Counselors, which she co-authored with Carmen Gill, Shannon Carl, and Casey Barrio-Minton. Dr. Stephanie F. Daly, EDD, is an assistant professor of counseling at Argosy University in Washington, D.C. Dr. Daly is a licensed professional counselor in Virginia, as well as a national certified counselor and an approved clinical supervisor. She specializes in working with individuals and groups from a wide range of multicultural backgrounds on counseling issues ranging from normal situational and developmental issues to living and coping with severe and persistent mental illness. Dr. Daly has published and presented regionally and nationally on the DSM-5. Welcome, Stephanie.
Thank you, Rebecca.
What do you consider to be the most relevant non-diagnostic changes between the DSM-4-TR and the DSM-5?
Yeah, this is a common question that I get from a lot of folks saying, you know, what are the biggest changes? So I really like to talk about two philosophical changes that you're not necessarily going to see changes to the actual text, but they're interwoven throughout the manual. The first one is it's really a shift in focus from phenomenological interpretations, so what I like to call the what, to identifiable pathophysiological orients, what I like to call the why. So looking at the previous iterations of the DSM, we basically were told what a disorder was, very categorical listing, if you were. We're shifting to kind of a why, and that's the pathophysiological lens. We're really looking at, you know, functional changes that result in our clients from disease or injury. I mean, it really is what, you know, psychologists and psychiatrists are kind of looking at as a biological model. So again, you know, we're moving from simple behavioral observations, so categorical symptoms, to kind of what's a result of biology. Mm-hmm. And you'll see this threaded throughout the manual. The second major philosophical change, if you will, is the use of dimensions as opposed to diagnostic categories. Now, this sounds very similar to the first philosophical change, the what to the why, mm-hmm. but it's actually much different. So diagnostic symptoms are actually being noted on a continuum. So our why, you know, why would someone have a traumatic and stressor-related disorder? Well, it would be as a result of having experienced a traumatic event. Mm-hmm. So looking at those diagnostic symptoms on a continuum, rather than specifically saying a client has X, Y, and Z. Now, another example besides trauma and stressor-related disorders, are substance use disorder. So previously in the DSM-4, instead of being substance abuse and substance dependence, two very clear categories, we now have one disorder called substance use disorder, mm-hmm. which we have specifiers and different indicators that look at this on a continuum. So again, while these two changes are pretty theoretically similar, each philosophy has a real unique impact on the way in which counselors will approach diagnosis, the way we'll approach treatment planning, and even the way that we communicate with other providers.
Mm-hmm. What about the removal of the multiaxial system and the GAF?
Absolutely. So this is something that a lot of counselors are like, what? Can't believe we got rid of the GAF. Other reactions to this have been, thank gosh, mm-hmm. because the GAF, as many of us know, is something that is very subjective, and that is exactly why it was removed. It really lacked clinical utility, meaning that, you know, one group of counselors in one agency would use the GAF one way, another group of counselors in a private practice would use the GAF in another way. And the scores were really just all over the board.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of, you know, dropping the GAF, there is a replacement, the HUDAS, which I'll talk about in just a second. But, you know, the dropping of the GAF has to do with replacing it with something else, lack of clinical utility. And it also points to, the first part of your question was like, what about removing the multi-axial diagnosis?
Mm-hmm.
So this is interesting. APA came out in the DSM-5 and they said, well, we never really told you to use the multi-axial system. We only suggested it. But many of us who have worked for a long time, you know, as professional counselors in all sorts of different settings, know that this is the mainstream of third-party reimbursement, the way that we manage interdisciplinary communication. I mean, you know, we kind of all have gotten very used to using it. So what the American Psychiatric Association is saying is that we're moving towards uniaxial assessment. And so what this uniaxial assessment means is that we would combine axes 1, 2, and 3. And so that means that in order of presentation, so whatever the client presents with, or the identifying or predominant diagnosis would be listed first. And I like to kind of give people a visual of, you know, if you had one line to write out the diagnosis, you know, it would literally be written out on one line. Now, don't take that too literally. You know,
mm-hmm.
two and three lines is fine. But the idea is that there's no more axis one, axis two, axis three. Mm-hmm. All of those would be listed in one line. And again, in order of presentation. Now, in terms of axis four, so there is an expanded list of V codes or 900 codes in the
mm-hmm.
DSM-5. And these, you know, individuals that are familiar with the DSM-4 or familiar with, you know, diagnostic nosology in general know that these codes are used for conditions that relate to neglect, sexual abuse, physical abuse.
Mm-hmm.
These will also be listed alongside the primary diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
So the suggestion is list out in order of presentation the primary diagnosis. A question, what if it's a V code?
Right.
Or what if it's a Z code? List it out first.
Mm-hmm.
It is an order of presentation.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, and I mentioned this before, there's no more axis five. So what we have the option of using is the World Health Organization Disability Assessment Schedule 2.0.
Mm-hmm.
What that would look like is, again, if you're kind of giving a visual of one line of diagnostic recording, you would write out the primary diagnosis, and then you could include the HUDAS 2.0 score.
Mm-hmm. The HUDAS is online as well as in print. Can you talk a bit about the online measures the American Psychiatric Association has published on their website, and are these required?
Yes, of course. So first I'd like to talk a little bit about what this website is.
Mm-hmm.
Online, this is www.psychiatry.org. It's the DSM-5 website hosted by the American Psychiatric Association. Has a listing of all sorts of assessments as well as instructions for scoring these assessments, interpreting guidelines, manuals, a lot of information.
Mm-hmm.
So these assessments, some of these are also in the print DSM-5.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly there wasn't enough room in the DSM-5 to include all of these measures, but the most pertinent, if you will, measures, and also the measures where there's the most psychometric information,
mm-hmm.
are actually printed in the manual. So when a counselor goes online, they're going to see four different groupings of measures.
Okay.
The first is the HUDAS, the World Health Organization Disability Assessment Schedule. I mentioned that one previously, mm-hmm. and I'll talk a little bit more in detail about that in just a second.
Good.
The second one are cross-cutting measures.
Mm-hmm.
The third are disorder-specific severity measures. And the fourth are kind of a bucket list called additional assessment measures.
Okay.
So I'll talk about each and every one of these groupings because I think it's really important that counselors are aware that these resources and tools are out there, but also that they're aware of really what they are. The language can get mm-hmm. a little bit confusing.
And I think counselors won't be so worried about losing the GAF or the GAF if they understand these measures. So
exactly.
Yeah, so go
exactly.
ahead.
Exactly. And I do have to say, you know, as a counselor, I certainly have looked at many, you know, psychological, neuropsychological assessments, you mm-hmm. know, that take hours and, you know, and they can often be confusing to read. These are not like that. They really are straightforward. Of course, there's limitations to these assessments.
Mm-hmm.
They're emerging measures. So, mm-hmm. again, psychometric properties are sometimes not as strong mm-hmm. as we would like to see, but they are a good toolkit.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, we'll start with the WHODAS,
yes.
the World Health Organization Disability Assessment Schedule mm-hmm. 2.0. I'm just going to call it the WHODAS.
Okay.
So what the WHODAS does, I like to think of it as a combination between the GAF and the mental status exam.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's, again, it's not required. None of these measures are required.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I say that with one caveat. There could potentially be a third-party billing system out there that wants you to submit a WHODAS score.
That's right.
So, again, with the caveat, but that would be specific to mm-hmm. that particular organization.
Mm-hmm.
In general, you know, the WHODAS is, and all of these measures are not required, but they are really good tools.
Mm-hmm.
So in looking at the WHODAS, there are six areas of functioning that are assessed. And it's, remember, it does say disability assessment schedule. So
mm-hmm.
it's got a very medical model taste to it, which many counselors might not like.
Right.
However, the six areas of functioning are understanding and communicating, so a client's mm-hmm. ability to, you know, be present and have a discussion, et cetera. A client's ability to get around, that's number two. Client's
mm-hmm.
ability for self-care, number three. Number four, getting along with people. Five is life activities, such as being able to maintain a household or work or school.
Right.
And then the last one is a client's ability to participate in society.
Mm-hmm.
So in this inventory, if you will, basically the counselor scores each one of these six areas of functioning and identifies areas of strength or areas in which the client might need some assistance.
Mm-hmm.
It is self-administered, so there are some you know, there are some challenges with self-administered assessments.
Right.
But, again, you know, the WHODAS is just one tool that's out there to assess
mm-hmm.
functioning. So, moving on, the cross-cutting measures.
Mm-hmm.
So, these measures, the basic idea here is that they identify specific areas and track progress.
Mm-hmm.
So there's two levels that might help break it down a little bit. There's two levels of cross-cutting measures. One is a brief survey that looks at 13 domains for adults, 12 domains for children. It is basically just all types of different symptomology.
Mm-hmm.
So it looks at all different symptoms. It can look at symptoms of depression, sleep disturbances, obsessive thoughts, substance abuse. I mean, it is a generalized inventory.
Right.
Different from the WHODAS, though, it doesn't focus on functioning.
Mm-hmm.
It focuses more on your emotional disturbances or, if you will, psychiatric problems.
Right.
So there's a level one assessment for adults. There's a level one cross-cutting assessment for children. And then there's a level one cross-cutting assessment for children aged 17 and between 11 and 17. Sorry
okay.
about that. So adolescents.
Right, right.
Now, level two. Level two is not always going to be used. If you administer a level one cross-cutting measure mm-hmm. and you find an area of inquiry or an area of concern, if you will, a counselor then might choose to look at a level two cross-cutting measure.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's many, many of these listed online. This is the bulk of what counselors are going to find online.
Mm-hmm.
The level two assessments provide a much more in-depth assessment of certain domains.
Mm-hmm.
And again, these, just like the level one cross-cutting measures, are specific for adults, children ages 6 to 7, or basically adolescents, but what APA calls them is children ages 11 to 17.
Mm-hmm.
But again, there's numerous of these, there's numerous assessments mm-hmm. listed under level two cross-cutting.
Right.
And these are going to address specific areas.
Mm-hmm.
Depression, anger, mania, anxiety, sleep, et cetera. Currently, there's 8 different types online for each age level, adults, children, and adolescents. So there's 24 assessments online. There's a lot.
Which is very confusing for a lot of counselors.
It is. It is. So the way I like to think about it is administer your level one.
Mm-hmm.
If there's something that jumps out at you, as diagnostically could be a presenting problem, look at level two. You've got your specific client age, and you've got a specific area that you can look at, depression, anger, mania, anxiety. You know, and if you have a client that's got a couple different things presenting, such as depression or anger, you might have to give them 2 level two assessments.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I do like the way it's laid out online. I think it makes a lot of sense, kind of the way that you can kind of see it grouped by age as well as by
right.
level one, level two.
Okay.
A lot of information.
I know. And what about the disorder-specific severity measures?
Yes. So the disorder-specific severity measures are dimensional assessments.
Mm-hmm.
And these... there's no level one, level two, there's no cross-cutting. This specifically looks at disorders.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the print edition of the manual, there is one listed in print, and you'll see that under the psychotic disorders. So under Section 3 in print of the DSM-5, you're going to see a listing of a psychotic disorder specific severity measure. That is the only one that's in print.
Mm-hmm.
However, there are a whole bunch online. And basically what these do is they just look for meaningful variations in symptom severity. So the idea here is that, and this goes back to that philosophical change
mm-hmm.
I talked about earlier, about looking at more of disorders on more of a continuum or a dimensional basis, as opposed to kind of a strict category.
Mm-hmm.
These severity measures say, okay, a client can have psychotic symptoms or even be diagnosed with a psychotic disorder. However, what level of severity does this client have?
Right.
Mild, moderate, severe, extreme. And these severity measures serve as a tool for helping counselors differentiate what that level of severity is.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So in practice, I've heard that some counselors really enjoy using these measures. Other counselors say, you know, it still speaks very loudly to the fact that our clients are varied in their symptom presentation, especially
right.
with severe mental illness and severe depression or severe psychosis.
Mm-hmm.
So again, these are emerging, but the psychosis severity measure is in print and has been considered to be quite reliable and quite useful.
Mm-hmm. Can you explain changes to the actual actual recording of the disorders? For example, what are the grayed-out numbers in parentheses in the DSM-5?
Yes. So the DSM-5 includes, you know, 2 sets of codes.
Mm-hmm.
One is the ICD-9, and one is the ICD-10. Now, for counselors who are, you know, using the DSM-5, you're going to see ICD-9-CM, ICD-10-CM. The CM just means clinical modification. So for the purposes of discussion, I'm just going to use ICD-9, ICD-10.
Okay, good.
So the ICD-9 codes are the codes that are actually in bold print that come first.
Mm-hmm.
ICD-9 codes were used in the DSM-4, and these codes are actually going to be phased out. Now, that's still up in the air, and I'll talk about that in a second.
Right.
But these codes are still relevant today. They're still being used today. We're still billing with ICD-9 codes.
Right.
But eventually, over the course of, you know, potentially next year in 2015, we will have to transition to ICD-10 codes.
It was going to be this year
in
October.
Yes.
And then a big change took place. Could you talk a little about that change?
Absolutely, absolutely. So there was a final rule of HIPAA that basically stated that all healthcare providers needed to switch over to the use of ICD-10 codes by October 1, 2014.
Mm-hmm.
So in reality, with the implementation of a brand new diagnostic manual, as well as the huge change that changing these coding systems would take. I mean, anyone who's filled out a third-party reimbursement form knows that number one is your ICD code, which you get from the DSM-5 or you actually get from the ICD. And so to switch over to a whole different coding system is a pretty tall order.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we've known about this for years.
Right,
so
absolutely.
This is not new news.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, not surprisingly, it was just, what was it, just last month mm-hmm. that the information came out that, you know what, third-party reimbursement systems aren't ready. And basically, because of the Affordable Care Act,
mm-hmm.
I think there was also a big movement to push the date
right.
of changing ICD-9 to ICD-10.
Because there were so many changes for medical doctors.
So many changes.
Right.
And this impacts anyone that's in the health profession.
Mm-hmm.
So what used to be thought of as, you know, the final rule, October 1, 2014, is up in the air right now.
Mm-hmm.
But at some point, we will be using ICD-10 CM codes. We don't know when.
Right.
I do feel confident that ACA will definitely let us know and let all counselors know. And
we will let all counselors
yes.
know. And
yes.
at this point, it's supposed to be October 1st of 2015, but let's see what happens.
Yeah, let's see. Let's see.
Yeah. What about recording substance use disorders? What changes have taken place there?
Okay, so substance use disorders, in my opinion, is one of the largest diagnostic changes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, it depends on the clientele that you tend to work with, and I've worked with a lot of substance abuse. But there is a considerable change in the way that we not only record, but the way we even think about substance use. So first, let me talk briefly about the significant changes to substance-related disorders, and then I'll talk a little bit about recording.
Okay, good.
So there's no longer a distinction between substance abuse and dependence.
Mm-hmm.
And I mentioned that before when I was talking about those philosophical changes.
Mm-hmm.
How we're really looking at spectrum diagnoses as opposed to specific categories. So we have substance use disorder. But what's really important is that specific substances are now considered distinctive disorders.
Mm-hmm.
So we have alcohol, cannabis, hallucinogen-related mm-hmm. disorders, caffeine-related disorders, inhalant. There's a very, very long list of disorders found within the DSM-5 and mm-hmm. at the end of the manual of these different disorders. And each one of these different disorders has different codes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, additionally, severity ratings have been added to indicate mm-hmm. mild, moderate, and severe levels. Now, all of these have distinct codes as well.
Mm-hmm.
So In making a diagnosis for a substance-related disorder, the first thing that counselors need to do is identify the criterion for the substance use disorders. And they'll be happy to know that the criterion for alcohol-related disorders mm-hmm. is pretty darn similar to caffeine-related disorders, which is they're all pretty the same. It was a factor mm-hmm. analysis that was done. There was 11 factors that came out of it. And so there's basically 11 criteria that we're looking at.
Mm-hmm.
Give or take a few changes for a few distinct substances.
Okay.
But so it's not as confusing as it seems. But the first thing that counselors will do is identify whether or not a disorder is present. Mm-hmm. The second thing that they'll do, and they'll probably do it concurrently with the diagnosis of a substance-related disorder, mm-hmm. is identify what the disorder is.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The next thing that they do is they must identify specifiers. So they need to identify mild, moderate, or severe. In identifying that mild, moderate, or severe, they can go to kind of the substance use disorders table mm-hmm. found at the back of the DSM-5, which I strongly recommend, and say, okay, so I've got alcohol use disorder moderate. That would be this code.
What if you're diagnosing somebody and you find out maybe five sessions in
mm-hmm.
that it's more severe or less severe than you initially thought?
Absolutely.
Can you change it then?
You can absolutely change it then.
Okay.
And as we know, theory versus practice,
mm-hmm.
that is what happens.
That is what
You know, a client comes in and says, oh, I have like one or two drinks
right.
a week, and then, you know, next thing you know, they're coming in telling you about the multiple binges that they've had between the last time they saw you, which was 7 days.
Right, right.
So absolutely. So you can change that.
Okay.
So counselors just need to remember that each specific substance use disorder has a specifier, and they also need to make sure that they look at other specifiers in early remission, in sustained mm-hmm. remission, on maintenance therapy, in a controlled environment, because in some cases, these will change the coding.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I really strongly encourage counselors to use that table at the end of the DSM-5. It's really helpful.
Right, right. And just going through the DSM-5 and looking at all of the tables and all of the different lists of severities and stuff, it is very helpful, don't you think?
I do. I absolutely do. I think what we're doing is really trying to find a way that counselors can use the DSM-5 in a way that's just friendly.
Yeah.
You know, that's just in a way that makes it, you know, high levels of clinical utility for all of us.
That's what we want. We want it to
yeah.
be clinical utility. Okay. Can you talk a bit about modifications to disorder classifications? For example, bipolar and depressive disorders now stand alone as separate chapters. Let me start that over again. Well, I said we want to go straight through, but it's not totally working yet. Okay. Can you talk a bit about modifications to disorder classifications? For example, bipolar and depressive disorders now stand alone as separate chapters.
Yes, absolutely. So there are actually, believe it or not, because we've added some disorders and taken away some disorders, there are roughly the same number of disorders in the DSM-4-TR as there are in the DSM-5. So the real big structural change
mm-hmm.
is the chapter organization.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So if you remember in the DSM-4, they had mood disorders. This is actually mood disorders, as you mentioned in your example, has been broken out into bipolar and depressive disorders. They are separate chapters.
Mm-hmm.
This goes back to the philosophy of looking at kind of the what to the why.
Mm-hmm.
So depression, as we as counselors know, is vastly different than bipolar. The clients
right.
present differently,
right.
Symptomology, as well as just the way that they interact within mm-hmm. the counseling setting. So this is actually a change that I think is really helpful to the way that counselors approach, you know, helping clients. So in addition to bipolar and depressive disorders being distinct, anxiety disorders have been broken into three separate chapters.
Mm-hmm.
Anxiety disorders, you know, we would have PTSD in anxiety disorders, we would have OCD in anxiety disorders,
right.
And anybody that works with these disorders knows that it's distinctively different
mm-hmm.
an OCD client than a client who just simply presents with panic attacks and maybe a panic disorder.
Mm-hmm.
And so kind of looking back at what's the origin of the psychological dysfunction,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so anxiety disorders are now broken into, there is a standalone anxiety disorders chapter.
Mm-hmm.
There's a new obsessive compulsive and related disorder chapter.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a new trauma and stressor related disorder chapter. So instead of having all of these classified as, oh, anxiety,
mm-hmm.
we've now broken them out into three separate chapters.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, as a clinician, I really hope that this will almost change the stigma related to, you know, having experienced a traumatic event or having situational stress factors, you know, that impact your ability to, you know, go to work and school, that's different
mm-hmm.
from, you know, an anxiety disorder or even an obsessive compulsive and related disorder.
Gender dysphoria is a new chapter.
Yes, yes, yes.
What is that about? Can you talk a little about that?
Absolutely. Gender dysphoria was removed from the sexual and gender identity disorders chapter.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit of my personal opinion here, which I try to keep out of these things.
No, we want to hear it. Go ahead.
Thank gosh. Thank gosh. We no longer are classifying gender dysphoria as a sexual disorder.
Yeah.
It is not.
Right.
And we're no longer even grouping it with a paraphilia, which was horrific to think was even the trend at some
mm-hmm.
point.
Mm-hmm.
But gender dysphoria includes gender dysphoria for adults and gender dysphoria for children and adolescents. And it really serves to show how we're moving in a direction of looking at standalone disorder classifications
mm-hmm.
for what the symptoms that the client is presenting with are and
mm-hmm.
the origin of these symptoms.
Yeah, yeah. Speaking of specific disorders, what do you think are the most significant diagnostic changes for counselors to know?
Yeah, great question. There's so many.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if I had to pick out just a few to talk about,
mm-hmm.
I do want to plug the book a little bit.
Yeah.
On page 25 of the book, we actually talk about major diagnostic changes. On page 20 of the book, we talk
right.
about major diagnostic changes, and that we list
I like
out
that. Yeah.
25. So check it out.
Yeah.
But there's my plug. But so the first one that you know, many people who followed the revisions of DSM are probably aware of, but
mm-hmm.
autism, Asperger's, childhood disintegrative disorder, and pervasive
right.
developmental disorders have all been replaced with one umbrella diagnosis, which is autism spectrum disorder.
Mm-hmm.
The purpose of this change was really to improve the efficacy of diagnosis,
mm-hmm.
the accuracy of diagnosis, and the consistency. And again, it goes back to looking at a dimensional approach.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the what some people are calling the removal of Asperger's, but looking at autism spectrum disorder, that's huge.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Schizophrenia spectrum and other psychotic disorders,
mm-hmm.
It removes special treatment of bizarre delusions and hallucinations.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a big deal. But even bigger of a deal is that schizophrenia no longer includes the five subtypes.
Mm.
So, for example, there's no longer is paranoid schizophrenia considered a subtype.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that's usually pretty shocking.
That's
to
very
folks.
Different, yeah.
Yeah. The addition of disruptive mood dysregulation disorder, and that would be in the depressive disorder section
Which a lot of people had issues with.
Yes, yes, this is a very controversial.
Can you talk a little about what those issues were?
Sure. I mean, basically, disruptive mood dysregulation disorder, or DMDD as you'll see it referred to throughout the literature, has been coined temper tantrum disorder.
Right.
Now, that is, it's certainly a very crude term, but it basically, the controversy is, are we labeling something that is developmentally appropriate?
Mm-hmm.
So mood dysregulation in children, are we labeling something that's just the way that children are as a disorder?
Right, right.
So, you know, I mean, the symptoms of DMDD, persistent irritability, persistent outburst, you know, three or more times a week for a year, you know, a lot of people have just said, well, that's a teenager.
Yeah, or that's a two-year-old. Yeah.
Or I have a two-year-old. So that's a two-year-old,
that's
and it
right.
is. Mm-hmm. You know, the argument was we're really trying to reduce the incidences of, you know, pediatric bipolar,
mm-hmm.
and DMDD specifically focuses on mood dysregulation, and so that differentiates some of the bipolar versus, mm-hmm. you know, mood dysregulation. Mm-hmm. The other thing was duration, and that's really why it ended up in the DSM-5, is
right.
that, you know, three or more times a week for an entire year.
Uh-huh.
According to the American Psychiatric Association and the work groups, is not a normal developmental state.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the duration and severity. Another thing that was interesting is many parents of children diagnosed with Asperger's were unhappy to see it going away
mm-hmm.
because they considered their children to be diagnosed on a very high-functioning part of the spectrum, and they didn't like seeing it go away. When I was at the American Psychiatric Association meeting last year, the person who was the head of that study group did say that, you know, if parents want to call their children Asperger's, if they want to use that word, that's still fine. It just, we can't use it when we're using diagnostics.
Yeah, and that makes it does make a lot of sense.
It doesn't have to be taken away from
it
those
doesn't have to be taken
who like
away.
It. Yeah.
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 Okay. So looking at some other major diagnostic changes, I think there's one or two more I would be remiss to not mention.
Okay.
The elimination of criterion E of a major depressive episode, which is, you know, the grief exclusion.
Mm-hmm.
That no longer applies. So,
big one. Yeah,
individuals who have experienced the loss of a loved one mm-hmm. can actually now be diagnosed with depression if, and this is a big if, they meet the other criteria for a major depressive episode.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
This was hugely controversial.
Yeah,
because people were afraid that individuals who were simply going through the natural grief process
mm-hmm.
were going to be diagnosed with depression.
Mm-hmm.
Well, APA and other proponents of this change said, well, but yeah, but on the flip side, individuals who have experienced grief but also are experiencing symptoms of major depression aren't able to get the services they need. They aren't able to be diagnosed appropriately. So,
mm-hmm.
again, many different sides to the argument.
Right.
But it was eliminated. The grief exclusion was eliminated.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little about the use of specifiers? I hear there are more specifiers in this edition than any other DSM to date. And this, again, is another thing that's a little confusing or daunting to our members.
It absolutely is. And if you could follow the substance abuse conversation about
mm-hmm.
coding that I had, you know, just a few minutes ago, that is a perfect example.
Mm-hmm.
There are more specifiers in this edition, and counselors really need to pay close attention to them. What I can tell you is that in the substance use disorder and in depressive disorders and even in some of the anxiety disorders, counselors really need to pay attention to the mild, moderate, and severe specifiers because they change coding.
Mm-hmm.
So what I would ask counselors to do is to really make sure that specifiers are no longer used as something that might be supplemental,
mm-hmm.
that they are actually integral to the coding and the recording of the diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing about specifiers is that there are more in this edition because of the removal
of the
GAF,
yeah.
of the multi-axial diagnosis system.
Yeah.
So absolutely. So it's really important. That's the way that we can communicate.
Mm-hmm.
Mild, moderate, severe, you know, with perceptual disturbances, without.
Mm-hmm.
It's really important for counselors to take a look at those.
Yeah. In a way, it's going to help us to be more accurate with our diagnosis.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
Yeah.
Once we get over the major confusion.
I know.
It will help us.
The confusion.
It will help us.
And some of that confusion is going to be dissipated when you sit down and go through the book.
Absolutely.
I really think that that's important. A lot of people have put off buying the book, and I understand that because they, you know, now that we don't have to use the ICD-10, I can understand some people are putting off buying the DSM-5. But it will, help with some of your concerns if you just sit down and go through it carefully and quietly in a room somewhere you can really concentrate.
Yeah, and I think what we tend to work with a specific client base. So if you work in substance use disorders, I really do feel confident that, you know, you can get the coding systems down and that begin to understand the specifiers. And there is a lot of repetition as you begin to use it, and it will become easier.
This next question is a really important question for counselors. What are some major practice implications for counselors who use the DSM? Specifically, how will the transition from the DSM-4-TR to the DSM-5 influence the work of professional counselors?
Yeah, and it's a great question. Thank you. First of all, coding and billing. You know, I mean, billing is something counselors are sometimes hesitant to talk about, but we need to get paid for the work that we do.
Absolutely.
Point blank.
Mm-hmm.
So figuring out these coding systems is really important.
Mm-hmm.
There is no universal rule right now for what each third-party billing system is doing.
Right.
So counselors need to connect with their billing system, whatever it is. If they're working with Medicaid, Medicare, TRICARE, mm-hmm. Blue Cross, whatever insurance panel.
Right,
specifically,
whatever panel.
Yes, specifically contact them and figure out what it is they want.
Mm-hmm.
That's number one. My experience in this last year has been, you know, status quo. We're doing the same thing.
Right.
So they're actually using the ICD-9. And
some are saying they're going to do the same thing for another year now.
Yes, exactly.
Because
The
ICD-10 delay. Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, the major practice implications for counselors are really trying to keep up with that.
Mm-hmm.
None of us want to hear, continue to have an open conversation, open dialogue with your insurance panel, but that's really what we're going to have to do. So I think that's the biggest one. The second one is a little bit more philosophical in nature, and it really involves a shift from the way that the American Psychiatric Association is looking at nosology or diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
You know, moving to this biological approach really has the potential to go strongly against the empowerment, strength-based approach, the wellness-based approach of the field of professional counseling.
Right.
And I think that is definitely something of concern.
Mm-hmm.
Removing the multi-axial system, you know, I don't care if you told us not to use it, or if it was only a suggestion, we were all using it.
That's right.
And we were using it because it made sense to us.
Mm-hmm.
Not just structurally, but because it included things like environmental, social, and cultural factors that counselors know cannot be left out of the client picture.
Right.
So moving away from, you know, that holistic look of a client and more to a biological based where every client can fit into like a mild, moderate, severe, and oh, but we have these severity measures, so we really are looking at people across a continuum. It's dangerous territory for counselors.
Yeah.
Other subtle shifts was replacing general medical condition mm-hmm. with another medical condition throughout the DSM-5.
Mm-hmm.
If everybody remembers in the DSM-4-TR, it was depressive disorder, you know, due to a general or another medical condition.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of saying general medical mm-hmm. condition, we're saying another medical condition. Mm-hmm. This puts mental health concerns and mental health diagnosis on the same plane as medicine.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it really implies that mental disorders at their core are medical issues. And counselors, we need to be really careful because this is, again, just a little bit of an inching towards biological explanations mm-hmm. of behavior and losing our holistic roots where we look at environment, culture, I mean, so many other things.
Strength base.
Uh-huh. Exactly.
Yeah.
So the other major practice implication I want to mention is just the use of the screening tools.
Mm-hmm.
And something I haven't talked about, but I really want to encourage counselors to check out, is the cultural formulation interview
mm-hmm.
that is found within the DSM-5.
As a counselor,
I have to say I actually enjoyed looking at that.
I like it a lot.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. I mean, it really helps us understand the client from a holistic worldview.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, contrary to what I just said about this biological thread throughout, the cultural formulation mm-hmm. interview is our one nugget of, okay, we're going to look holistically at the client. So using those screening tools, I really do think is a major implication for counselors.
And aren't we hearing a lot about neuroscience these days from
yes.
counselors, not just from psychiatrists and psychologists, but from counselors?
Yeah, and you're going to find a lot of, you know, findings from neuroscience research and a lot of genetic findings threaded throughout the DSM-5.
Mm-hmm.
I always encourage counselors to buy the big DSM-5, the one that has all the information in it.
That's right.
Because that, you know, it goes through not only the recording procedures and the diagnostic features, but it also looks at culture-related diagnostic issues, mm-hmm. risk factors. So in eating disorders, for example, we know that anorexia is the most fatal eating disorder. There's actually information in there
mm-hmm.
now about that. So all of that research, and you're right, a lot of neurological research is in there,
mm-hmm.
which is great. However, we need to be cautious because of not everything is due to a biological
mm-hmm.
finding or biological roots.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Another reason why counselors need to learn how to use the DSM-5, even if they, you know, don't like it that much, is to if they will think about that single mother who can, the only way she's going to get counseling for her child is if she can pay a $10 copay.
Yeah.
That's the only way she's going to get counseling for her child. So for that child, I think it's worth it for all of us to learn how to use the DSM-5 and be able to render a diagnosis that you can put on an insurance form that will help these families who cannot afford to see to get counseling any other way.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
When are counselors going to start using the DSM?
Oh.
No, that's what people ask me that every day. And, so when?
Well, the famous answer, mm-hmm. it depends.
That's right.
Really, and I'm sure this is the answer that you give folks, is mm-hmm. really whenever their agencies or third-party reimbursement systems, insurance panels,
mm-hmm.
change their billing procedures.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we might have the modification to the final rule. It might be October 1st, 2015.
Yeah.
You know, I tell people if you have, you know, if you have a good relationship with your third-party billing system
mm-hmm.
right now, I tell students who might be taking an LPC exam or,
mm-hmm.
you know, the NCE or the NCMHCE that,
right.
well, it's already on the exam.
Yeah, yeah.
So as of April of this year, April 2014, it's already included on the exam. So
so they need to learn. They have.
So counselors in training need to learn it. And for counselors currently in practice,
mm-hmm.
Really it depends on your insurance panel and whoever your third-party reimbursement
Right. One of the bigger insurance companies that I spoke to last week was telling me that they were ready to come out with something. They didn't feel quite good about their new form. And they took this change for the ICD-10 to October 1st, 2015 as a way to pull back and start rethinking the form they were about to come out with. So I think that's probably not going to be that unusual to see that kind of thing.
Yeah, I would agree. I would agree. And very encouraging that people have some time to pause.
Well, this has been really fascinating. I want to thank you so much for talking to us today. And I wanted to end our interview by telling you that ACA now has over 55,000 members, most of whom are clinicians. Is there anything I have not asked you that you want our members to know?
You know, I just think it's really important that counselors have an active seat at the table during discussions about the DSM-5, especially during iterations, future iterations of the DSM-5, which would be the DSM-5.1.
Right.
I also think it's important that we serve to advocate for our clients, you know, and that we continue to speak very loudly and clearly about the profession of counseling, what we do. We don't allow a biological model to take over, and we continue to advocate for people who, like you said before, they need the services.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Stephanie Bailey, for joining us today to discuss DSM-5, Learning Companion for Counselors. To view links to this program, to buy the book, to write to the presenter or the host, please go to www.counseling.org and click on the podcast page. This is Dr. Rebecca Daniel Burke, your host for the ACA 2014 podcast series, signing off.